This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business? You think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really gotta rap and be all that. But prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, why are successful movie directors stooping so low as to work in TV? Then, the venerable summer metal blowout known as Ozfest becomes Freefest. And finally, the writer speaks again. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Don't go anywhere. It's The Business from NPR. We begin the caravan with dire news from the music business. UK-based EMI, the world's fourth largest music company, issued its second profit warning in as many months. As a result of a sharp drop in sales stateside, numbers at EMI's recorded music division are likely to be down 15% when it releases its yearly fiscal results next month. But while the company is actually doing worse than expected, it's doing better than the music business as a whole. According to SoundScan, the physical music market declined by 20%. EMI might be a bloodied prizefighter with a cauliflower ear, but at least it can proudly say, you should see the other guy. In related news, 23 overseas mobile phone operators and most of the major music labels banded together last week to offer a new cellular music service. The service, called Music Station, will be provided by British mobile music company Omniphone to 690 million mobile subscribers across Europe and Asia. Thanks largely to Apple's iTunes, CD sales are in free fall. And the record companies are over an apple barrel because iTunes controls 75% of the online music market. But the labels hope that Music Station will swing the balance of power back to them by giving users the ability to search, download, and play music on their cell phones and then sync it with their personal computers. The cost? Less than a latte at $3.88 per week. What's more, there's nothing to buy. Music Station is compatible with 75% of the handsets that are already on the market, and it can be downloaded directly to the mobile phone, even if it doesn't include a music player. Reached for comment, Apple's Steve Jobs said, "Go!" In live music news, Al G. Gore, announced plans for a 24-hour pop concert across seven continents to mobilize action against global warming. According to organizers, the so-called Live Earth concerts on July 7th will bring together more than 100 of the world's top musical acts. While names were not announced, we expect to see bands like Air Supply, The Cars, and Hothouse Flowers. And finally, in music-related film news, Universal Pictures has acquired the rights to make a feature about Milli Vanilli, the lip-syncing braided pop stars who rose from obscurity only to quickly return there. Jeff Nathanson, who wrote the Steven Spielberg film Catch Me If You Can, about teenage con artist Frank Abagnale Jr., will direct his own script this time around. He's also secured the cooperation of the estate of the late Rob Paletus and from the very living Fabrice Morvan. Asked about the veracity of the story, Morvan said, "Girl, you know it's true. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later on the show, Ozzy and Sharon Osbourne announced that tickets for their Ozfest heavy metal tour will be free. Have they lost their minds? That's probably a bad question. But anyway, coming up next, television, get some respect. There was a time when you only worked in television because you couldn't get work in the movies. But more and more successful film directors are directing TV pilots and even producing and creating shows. One reason is that the networks are making fewer pilots, but they're spending more on the ones they do make. So they're more like movies. But unlike making a movie, the time commitment is months, not years. And if you get a piece of the show, directing the pilot can pay you for the rest of your life. Brett Ratner is a huge film director who's been getting more and more into TV. He directed X-Men 3, Red Dragon, and the Rush Hour franchise. but he's also an executive producer of the Fox hit Prison Break, and he directed the show's pilot as well. His new ABC series called Women's Murder Club will hopefully hit airwaves this fall. Based on the book by James Patterson, Ratner calls the show Desperate Housewives meets CSI. We reached him on his cell phone on the way home from a long day of shooting on his latest film, Rush Hour 3. Brett Ratner, welcome to the business.
Thank you.
So the question I want to know is, why do television at all? I mean, you're not exactly lacking for fortune or fame as a director. Mm-hmm. Why do it?
You know, in my opinion, television over the years, and until recently, I mean, has really, the quality of television has improved. I mean, and I mean from the writing to the actors that have chosen to be in television shows. So there's no longer stigma with television, and the quality of the writing is really what attracted to me. When I was first pitched Prison Break, I just thought it was a genius idea. And I said, wow, I want to be a part of this, especially since the writer and the creator, Paul Schering, came up with not only the pilot concept, but the entire first season, and what happens during this next second season, and then what happens during the third season. So I knew it was something that was worthy of my time, because it was something that, if I executed properly, was going to continue, if it was popular, of course, season after season after season.
So there's a sort of narrative thread in the approach to television now that maybe wasn't there before.
Yeah, and not only that, I think the TV studios have gone for more quality shows. Meaning that they allow me to bring my crew for my feature films. For instance, on Prison Break, Dante Spinotti, who shot Red Dragon for me and X-Men and Family Man, actually shot Prison Break for me.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm able to afford all my crew, it's just the only difference between a pilot for a TV show and a feature is that for a feature, we'll shoot for 70 to 100 days, and on a pilot, we'll shoot for 14 days.
Well, that's the next question I wanted to ask you, is what can and can't you do when directing for TV as compared with film?
For me, it's about the writing. Good scripts attract great actors.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really why I'm in it for. I'm in it to work with the best actors I can work with and to tell great stories. And so when I get a script like Prison Break, like a script like Women's Murder Club or Blue Blood, I say, you know what, this is something that I want to do, because I'm still doing, there's no difference between a day on a TV show for me than there is a day on a feature film. Mm-hmm. I'm directing actors, I'm telling stories, and that's what I always dreamed of doing. So, and like I said, there's no longer a stigma. The quality of television has increased tremendously. I mean, Meryl Streep and, you know, brilliant actors are now doing great TV.
Mm-hmm. Are people sort of nervously watching the clock and the budget and saying, are we going over here, or is it a tighter belt?
I think there's a little bit of a tighter belt, but it's a challenge for me. You know, usually on a big feature, I'm only doing a few setups a day, where, you know, or maybe a page or two a day of dialogue. On a TV show, I'm challenging myself and saying, okay, how do I tell the story in a simpler way, less complicated way, less coverage, but in a more efficient way? So it's kind of, TV is an opportunity for me personally to kind of hone my skills in as a filmmaker and tell a story differently than I normally would.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't have the luxury of time, because I only have 14 days the most to do a television show, and I don't have the luxury of all the time on my hands, you know, I have to figure out, how do I tell a simpler story in less time and less days? And I remember the first day I shot on Prison Break, and I shot 5 pages of dialogue. My AD, my assistant director, who was with me from the beginning, stopped and made an announcement and said, ladies and gentlemen, that is the first time Brett Ratner has ever shot 5 pages of dialogue in the history of his career.
What do networks get when they hire you? I mean, television directors are typically these sort of faceless, unknown folks behind the camera. Why hire you? What do you do that they don't get with some sort of faceless director?
I think, you know, it's part of the whole package. You know, television is based on profitability, and when they sell it to the other, I guess when they're selling a pilot, you know, to all the channels or whatever they're saying, from the director of Red Dragon and Rush Hour, and maybe it brings a little bit of cachet.
Mm-hmm.
For me, there's not a big difference between myself and a nameless director, or, you know, a faceless director, whatever you call it. But I think maybe my name helps bring a little bit of weight to the package.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, on top of that, I think I'm able to, you know, to get actors that normally probably wouldn't do TV.
That's interesting.
Because of maybe their interest or excitement of working with me based on being a fan of my past work.
Mm-hmm. Or you may have previous relationships with them from the feature world, and now you say,
absolutely,
hey, let's go do this together. This might be fun. Brett Ratner is currently shooting Rush Hour 3. He's the executive producer of Prison Break, and hopefully this fall, Women's Murder Club. Brett, thanks for being on The Business.
Thank you.
Ozzy Osbourne's summer celebration of metal music called Ozfest has been one of the more successful touring shows for more than a decade. In cities large and small around the country, you can find pimply-faced teenagers in black t-shirts rocking out to Ozzy and bands like Hatebreed, Avenged Sevenfold, and Dragon Force. But Ozfest hasn't been immune to the recent downturn in the touring business or the rising cost of talent. So they're trying something new this year. But what they're trying is pretty revolutionary. Or insane. Here's a tape of Ozzy and his wife and business partner Sharon Osbourne at the press conference announcing Ozfest 2007.
Thank you so much for everyone being here today. Ozzy?
Hello.
Go on.
We've got an announcement to make. This year's Ozfest is...
At this point, Ozzy takes a can of spray paint and slowly scrawls the word free on the banner behind them, effectively turning Ozfest into Free Fest. So it seems that the way they're battling declining ticket sales is by getting rid of them altogether, which certainly solves the problem of declining ticket sales. Harder to understand is how they're going to make any money at all. Perhaps Jeff Leeds can explain it to us. He's the music business reporter for the New York Times. Jeff Leeds, welcome to The Business.
Thank you.
Now, before we get into the specifics of why this is a big deal, we should sort of point out or give people a thumbnail sketch of the touring business, which is maybe not in the best of shape right now. Explain a little bit about what's happening in touring and what the problems facing the whole business are.
There's a couple sort of structural problems. And one of the biggest is, as a lot of consumers probably know, that ticket prices generally haven't been going down the last couple of years. They've been going the opposite direction. And it's becoming harder and harder for concert promoters to get consumers to pay some of the high prices that they're asking to come out and see various acts. So the promoters sort of feel a bit trapped, if you will, because the ticket price comes from a couple different factors. One of them is what is the promoter paying the talent, and what are the production costs that talent wants to sort of spend to put on their show. And as those figures go up, promoters feel like they are stuck because they feel like they have to pay the talent what it costs, and that is going to trickle down to the ticket price.
So we're looking at the $500 Rolling Stones ticket. But the other problem, I would think, would be hair color. Babs, Stones, these are all AARP folk, aren't
right.
they?
Yeah, no, that's a sort of profound problem that's on the minds of a lot of promoters. And Ozfest, although it generally is considered an event that plays to a younger crowd, was actually at the forefront of tours that were trying to figure out what to do, because Ozzy himself, you know, is in his 50s, and last year was the first time that they just sort of said from the outset, you know, he's not going to play every show. He's not going to play all, you know, two dozen or so of the show dates. I think he ended up playing about half of them. And so a really big question was, how does an event like Ozfest go on without Ozzy Osbourne, its sort of namesake? And there was considerable debate, as I think there will be this year, about whether Ozfest, this sort of giant brand name rock tour, is really about, you know, going to see Ozzy Osbourne, who's sort of an icon of heavy metal, or whether it's really about the overall Ozfest experience, which is a very sort of broad thing where, you know, people go and barbecue and drink beer and see, you know, other bands like last year's System of a Down or Disturbed or Avenged Sevenfold. They came to a point where they thought, well, attendance, you know, at that tour has been actually sort of declining for the past couple of years. They did something like 575,000 people in 2001, and last year It was about flat from the year before at around 440,000.
So that's a big drop off.
So they've taken a big drop over the years, and I think you know, as the talent costs have gone up, they've sort of got to a point where they said, we have got to do something else because it's not working, you know, financially as well as we'd like.
Yeah, I think Sharon Osbourne gave an interview to the Mercury News and basically said that a System of a Down cost $300,000 plus to do an hour's work on stage.
Right.
Now, you multiply that over the cost of a tour with, you know, 40, 50 cities, you're into, as they say, a million here, a million there.
Right.
Suddenly you're talking about real money.
It's not quite that many cities. It's more like 25, but you are talking about real money. And so what I think, and Sharon actually sort of gives a bit of this away at the press conference they held, that they really were sort of fed up with the increasing talent costs. And I think they, you know, were probably struggling to turn much of a profit given the cost that they had and given that the fact that the attendance was not really increasing anymore. You know, it sort of flattened out. And so, you know, they decided, let's sort of scrap the model and kind of go for kind of a completely different take here. Now, Sharon also said at the press conference, I think away from the stage, we're not making any money. And which I found sort of fascinating because, you know, even though, you know, Sharon is often seen in the company of, you know, 75 Pomeranians, she's not she's not exactly kind of a soft touch and is not operating Ozfest as a charity and is considered a very shrewd and savvy and very tough deal maker. Mm-hmm. And so I expect that what's happened here is, you know, she's looked at this and said, you know, we have a better shot of making money if we come up with a different idea. And so the idea is, let's completely do away with the talent cost, right? There's not going to be any other big name talent on this tour except for Ozzy Osbourne. I understand there may be one or two kind of medium sized name bands that play some dates, but it's essentially back to being the Ozzy Osbourne tour. Mm-hmm. And so there's sort of this is the gamble. It's, you know, you sacrifice some number of people probably by having not as high wattage talent. Do you gain, you know, do you sort of offset that by having a free concert? And remember that the promoter and the Osbournes will be making plenty of money from everything that's not going to be free here, right? People are paying for parking, they're paying for t-shirts, they're paying who knows what for beer. And all of that money flows in one way or another, you know, back to the promoter, Live Nation, and the Osbournes.
So while it's free to listen, it's not free to drink, it's not free to park, it's not free to clothe yourself in a free fest tee.
Right.
And that's where the money is, the merch.
That's absolutely true. Ozzy actually had the best joke of the day. He said, it's actually free to come to the tour, but you have to pay to leave.
Right.
which I don't think is the case. But I think that, you know, they're going to sort of gamble. And actually, the most important thing that we haven't talked about is that they have a tremendous level of corporate sponsorship on this tour. And I have to wonder whether they sold those sponsors on last year's attendance figures or on whether they sort of imagined what they think attendance will be this year and sold them on that. Because I think it's quite a gamble, as I said, to sort of just say that, well, we're going to completely change the model and hope that we have at least the same attendance we did last year.
Yeah, free doesn't equal necessarily full, right?
Free doesn't equal full because, you know, you can't necessarily guarantee that people are going to show up to only to see Ozzy. As respected as he is, I think even more so than last year, this will be the year that determines whether Ozfest is truly about coming to see Ozzy Osbourne, the sort of icon of heavy metal, or whether it really is about seeing these other bands that have certainly helped kind of pull the crazy train the last couple of years.
Nicely done. Jeff Leeds writes about music and the music business for the New York Times. Jeff, thanks for being on the business.
Anytime.
Coming up after a short break, The Writer Speaks. You're listening to The Business from NPR. This is The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. The Writers Guild Foundation and Tall Fellow Press have published a book called Doing It for Money, The Agony and Ecstasy of Writing and Surviving in Hollywood. It's filled with essays from successful writers about the business of writing for film and TV. In the seventh installment of our regularly irregular series we call The Writer Speaks, Chris Brancato came down to our studio to talk to us. He wrote the feature screenplays for Hoodlum and Species 2, created the Sci-Fi Channel show First Wave, and has written for Beverly Hills 90210, The X-Files, The Outer Limits, Boomtown, and North Shore.
Depending on what segment of the business you're in, it bestows upon you a certain attitude. So if you're an agent, you have to assume a certain attitude. If you're a writer, you invariably assume a certain attitude. Usually less confident, more beaten and bedraggled than an agent, that's for sure. The role of the writer as underconfident, put upon, beaten and bedraggled, as I said, is something that probably has something to do with the general nature of writers, but the business also helps to exacerbate that. It's a nature versus nurture argument. I think people get attracted to certain jobs in the industry because their nature is one sort or another, and then the jobs themselves become further honed. You know, for instance, I find managers who represent actors to always be as touchy and prickly and, frankly, what's the word for it, overhyped as their clients probably are or as their clients act. So they are a reflection of their clients. If their clients are very hot, they act like they're very hot. I'm going through a casting process right now where I'm dealing with a lot of managers, so that's why I bring that up.
Here's Chris Brancato telling the story, The Cat Stays in the Picture.
I sat in the cutting room at MGM as the final reel of Species 2 played on an editing machine. Hunched over the machine was none other than the studio president. Here I was, the lowly writer, debating the final cut with the president of MGM, a studio with a long, proud history. I'd been hired to script the sequel to the MGM hit film Species, written by Dennis Feldman. For those unaware, Species detailed the emergence on Earth of Syl, a half-human, half-alien beauty whose danger lay in procreation. If you fell into her libidinous clutches, the resultant offspring could well destroy the planet Earth.
We decided to make it female so that it would be more docile and controlled.
More docile and controlled.
I guess you guys don't get out much.
My sequel centered on Patrick Ross, a heroic astronaut infected with alien DNA on mankind's first mission to Mars. In order to stop Patrick's rampant sexual congress with adoring groupies, the U.S. government uses a laboratory clone of the original Syl, now named Eve, to hunt down and kill Patrick before his offspring spell doom for the planet. In my script, Eve defeats Patrick in a furious battle, though she too is killed. The wrap-up scene of Species 2 is the burial of Patrick. In a classic government cover-up, he's buried with full military honors. The public will never know how close it came to being alien puppy chow. Back to the MGM cutting room, where the president announced that three of his previous movies ended in funerals. They all flopped at the box office. Though these movies were wholly unrelated to Species 2, a funeral scene at ending is a no-no. We'll have to reshoot. I dutifully went home to write a new ending. In the climactic battle of Species 2, Eve and Patrick engage in a fight to the death. Like a praying mantis, Eve may have reproduced with her male counterpart prior to ripping out his lungs. Both Patrick and Eve are killed in the battle, but the question remains, was Eve impregnated? If so, the offspring would be twice as powerful as any alien seen before. My new ending featured Eve's body in a military ambulance. She lies peaceful in death. As the ambulance engine rumbles, there's a vague tremor beneath the sheet that covers her body. With growing horror, we realize what has happened. Eve has been impregnated, and even though she's dead, the alien physiology is such that she will give birth to a lethal offspring. As her belly grows and grows, gestation on fast forward, we smash to black. End of movie. On to Species 3. I faxed my new scene to the president's office and nervously awaited a response. Many hours and cups of coffee later, the phone rang. It was the president himself. Love that scene, he said. Only one change. When we see Eve's been knocked up, let's pan to the corner of the ambulance and see one of Patrick's half-human, half-alien kids sitting in the corner. With great deference, I suggested that the alien offspring had been eradicated by our heroes earlier in the picture. To have an alien love child in the ambulance would suggest that our heroes had been unsuccessful in their job. A screw-up of possibly world-ending proportions. Hey, there were at least 30 alien offspring in the picture, he argued. Anyone could have missed one of those things. Not even Michael Madsen is perfect. I hung up the phone, demoralized. But soon my spirits lifted. I would call my producer. Surely he'd protect my scene from this harebrained idea. The producer answered the phone curtly. Loved your scene. Music to my ears. I told him about the alien love child suggested by the MGM president. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard, he said. I agreed with great relief. But, he continued, I've got a better idea. My blood ran cold. When I produced Friday the 13th, Part 8, the producer said, the director had this cat jump into frame in the house where Jason was hiding. The audience in the test screening nearly pissed their pants. I waited, not daring to breathe. How about when we see Eve's belly growing, suddenly, whoosh, a cat jumps into frame? How'd a cat get into a military ambulance, I asked. But the producer wasn't fettered by logic. It's in the woods, he cried. Cats live in the woods. The producer told me to call the president and tell him about the cat. No matter what that jerk says, my producer warned, the cat stays in the picture. I dejectedly called the president and told him about the cat. Dumbest idea I ever heard, he said. I agreed, but suggested we drop the alien love child and hope the cat had the same effect on our audience that it did in Friday the 13th, Part 8. No, said the president in a tone that reminded me of the ease with which writers get replaced. The alien love child stays in the picture. We write because we dream. We write because ink flows from our pens like blood in our veins. We write because we've been fired from every other useful occupation we've ever had. But to make a living as a writer is to accept the compromises that come in a collaborative medium. Most of the time, collaboration raises your work to a higher level. But not always. In the end, the cat stayed in the picture. But so did the alien love child. They both got their way, and I got writing credit on one of the dumbest scenes in modern film history. If you're catatonically depressed and in need of a chuckle, I suggest you rent Species 2 and fast forward to the final scene. Given the box office tally of this movie, MGM could use the rental fee.
And that's The Business. Matt Holtzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Club Professor Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
You've been listening to KCRW's The Business. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including The Treatment, a weekly conversation with some of the most influential and innovative people in movies and popular entertainment, hosted by film critic Elvis Mitchell. Check out the podcast of The Treatment at kcrw.com.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new 7-passenger MDX. More information is available at acura.com.